Several of you have commented, I didn't think it would be that noticeable, about this orange thing in my pocket. Orange not being the normal color for a Sooner fan, and I understand that. My friend Tom was teaching Bible class this morning, and this was his first time in the auditorium. So out of deference and respect to him, I wore my little orange, you know, pocket dilly whopper. And, you know, it doesn't change how deeply I love the color orange and how much I care about it. It just, you know, was a kind thing to do to him. We're going to continue our series in the book of Luke, mostly in Luke chapter 10 today. We've been looking at the topic of Jesus as a teacher and of what it is that he teaches us and how that he taught us, the many things that he does. Today, last week we talked about Jesus teaching us goodness and what it means to be good. We're going to escalate that just a little bit today and talk about what it means to listen, but the two are going to be related if you'll pay attention to it. Listening might not sound like something you have to learn. Isn't that just something that you come programmed with? Your ears either work or they don't. Every mother in the room just said, shook their head, like without prompting, all of you immediately got it. Because you understand that listening is not a skill that does come programmed. We learn very quickly how not to listen, how to tune out and ignore. And it turns out there is a moral component of listening. There's something about character that goes into listening that we have to learn and recognize and its value. Last week we talked about what it means to be good. So I thought I'd open up with just a thought about whether or not we recognize good as a way to set up this lesson. In Luke, the 9th chapter in verse 53, Jesus is passing through the villages of Samaria, and it said the people did not receive him. It explains why. He had his face set towards Jerusalem. It was very clear that he had other things to be about, and he was moving on. But for whatever, you know, whatever that caused in the people, some respect towards Jesus, they ultimately do not receive Jesus in the Samaritan villages and hear him gladly. On the other hand, in today's text, which begins in Luke chapter 10 and verse 38, it says Martha welcomed him into her home and began immediately preparing a meal for him in hospitality. So if I asked you off the top of your head, which of these two is a good response to Jesus? I'm not actually taxing your mental facilities very much. I think most of you would say, okay, welcoming Jesus, good, rejecting Jesus, bad. Right? That much we got from last week's lesson. There's a difference between good and bad, and that's a real distinction. This week, however, we're going to be asked to do something a little bit trickier, a little bit more difficult, and something that plays largely in the decisions you make as a Christian. And that is trying to recognize not just good and bad, but good and better. So look, for example, at our text. Let me just read the first two verses. Now, as they went on their way, Jesus entered a village, and a woman named Martha welcomed him into her house. And she had a sister called Mary, who sat at the Lord's feet and listened to his teaching. Right off the bat, neither of these women are like the Samaritans who rejected Jesus. Neither of these women are doing something that we would say, that's bad, that's immoral, that's evil. Nobody in this text is obviously identified as a sinner, morally depraved. But there is a difference in the text that comes about very clearly soon enough between the moral response of Mary and the moral response of Martha, that they are different. It's not a question between good and bad, but it is an important distinction between good and better. One of these is more appropriate. One is more becoming of a Christian disciple, and one is less. So I want to emphasize that because a lot of times in Christian conduct, we'll say, this thing is better than that thing, and somebody will immediately say, well, you're saying what I'm doing is not good? Well, nobody's saying that. What we're saying is, in Christian life, we have a lot of options. We have a lot of behaviors we can pick from, a lot of opportunities. And the challenge we have is to find better, to find the best way, in fact, to follow Jesus in our life and conduct. Martha is asking for a verdict on exactly this question because she believes she knows the answer, right? She believes that she can recognize which one of these two people has done something better. And so in verse 40, she says, Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to serve alone? Tell her then to help me. Martha has already rendered her verdict. She is convinced that one of these two things is better than the other. In fact, I don't know, I don't want to put words in Martha's mouth or thoughts in her brain. She might even think it's one of those good and bad distinctions. What I'm doing is clearly good. Jesus, tell my sister what she's doing is bad. Tell her to stop it and come over here and do this thing. She's looking for a verdict. Which one of these is right? And she's already made up her mind about which one is which. You can understand why she might think the way that she does. The first thing, and let me just say this as a preamble to this whole lesson. Some passages in Scripture need to be studied, and some need to be meditated upon. This is not actually a study passage. Like, it's four or five verses long. There's not a lot of deep detail. If you go read it in the Greek text, you don't suddenly understand it better and the lights come on. It's not one of those passages where if you just get a better commentary, you'll understand it better. This is one of those passages that you just have to sit and think about personally, reflect upon, and say, what's going on in the story and how much does that look like me? And there's just a moral component to it that's not intellectual at all. The more you think about it, you don't learn something intellectually and suddenly know the story better. You end up knowing yourself better if you'll pay attention. And one way to do that is to try for a moment to think of this as a court case. I said a moment ago that Martha wants a verdict. Judge my sister. Think of for a moment if you were the attorney in this court case. Okay? You start out and you are Martha's attorney. What case would you build to say that Martha is doing the best right thing she can do, and Mary is not? It's not actually a hard case to build. First of all, we would build the principle on hospitality, which is a critical ancient responsibility. In the ancient world, we don't have a lot of Motel 8s. When you travel from place to place, you are completely dependent on the hospitality of other people. And recognizing that, ancient culture saw as one of the best, most highly valued virtues you could have is to be a hospitable person, to take care of strangers that wander in and need a place to stay and provide them safety and comfort and ease and rest and food. Right? That's not a hard virtue to sell in the ancient world. It's a pretty easy virtue to sell today. We still like hospitality, right? We still like it when people open up their homes to us and provide for us a meal or whatever it is they can provide. That kind of kindness, we just immediately recognize that and say, that's a good thing to do. In fact, last week we studied the Good Samaritan, and that's kind of a version of hospitality, hospitality on the go. He doesn't open up his own home. He says, let me take you somewhere where I can pay to have you provided for, right? That's just good. Nothing wrong with that. And it comes from one of the most central stories of the Old Testament, the story of Abraham and his wife Sarah. For Jewish people, it wasn't just it's a pretty good idea. It was one of the centerpieces of the character of their people's founding character, patriarch, Abraham and his wife Sarah. Let me read to you just a moment. I won't ask you to turn there, but let me read to you from a familiar story, I think, from Genesis, the 18th chapter, where beings of heavenly nature, I'll admit the text is a little confusing. Sometimes it says it's God, and sometimes it says it's an angel, and sometimes it says it's a man, and I don't know. Figure it out. But beings of heavenly substance show up at a place called Mamre, where Abraham and his family and servants and so forth are camping, making their residence. And here's what happens in that text, beginning in verse 1. And the Lord appeared to him by the oaks of Mamre, as he sat at the door of his tent in the heat of the day. He lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, three men were standing in front of him. When he saw them, he ran from the tent door to meet them and bowed himself to the earth and said, O Lord, if I have found favor in your sight, do not pass by your servant. Let a little water be brought and wash your feet and rest yourselves under the tree, while I bring a morsel of bread that you may refresh yourselves, and after that you may pass on. Since you have come to your your servant. And Abraham went quickly into the tent to Sarah and said, quick, 3 seahs of fine flour, knead it and make cakes. And Abraham ran to the herd and took a calf, tender and good, and gave it to a young man who prepared it quickly. Then he took curds and milk and the calf and he had prepared and set it before them. And he stood by them under the tree while they ate. Okay, this is one of the basic stories, if you're Jewish, of your identity. We're the descendants of Abraham, and Abraham met God one day. And when Abraham met God one day, he received him. Did you hear the way Abraham spoke? He didn't say, would you like a drink of water? Never crossed his mind. He said, please let me give you a drink of water, right? As if you would be offending him if you did not receive this hospitality. He even says, if you have to go on afterward and can't stay the night, we understand. But since you're here, please pause and let us provide for you. Anybody have a grandmother or mother like that, that you come by the house and she says immediately, let me fix you something, right? And is deeply offended if you don't eat. I've known many women like this in my life, which is responsible for my general shape. There are people that just say, you have to eat. You're here. This is a requirement, right? And that's kind of the way Abraham and his wife Sarah respond. Hey, you're passing by. You have to stop. And of course, we'll provide some water. We'll wash your feet. Quick, let's make some cakes. Quick, let's get a lamb. And there's a feast prepared. And then the story goes on from there. This story is so important to Jewish identity that in the book of Hebrews in the New Testament, it's referenced kind of obliquely where it says, don't forget to show hospitality because some, in doing so, have entertained angels unaware. Right? You never know who you're being hospitable to. So always be hospitable. So if I'm a lawyer making the case for Martha, I've got pretty good ground, right? You look for precedent. She acted like Abraham and Sarah. Sounds good to me. And more than that, we can even say she is following the instructions of Jesus himself in this same chapter. If you back up a little bit to Luke, the 10th chapter, verses 5 through 12, Jesus gives his limited commission, which is instructions to the 70 disciples to go out and to teach. And as they go, he explains, how is it going to work? He tells them, you're not going to provide for yourself. Instead, you're going to depend on the hospitality of people who welcome you. Look at verses 5 through 12. It says, whatever house you enter, say, peace be to this house. And if a son of peace is there, your peace will rest upon him. But if not, it will return to you and remain in the same house, eating and drinking what they provide, for the laborer deserves his wages. Do not go from house to house. Whenever you enter a town and they receive you, eat what is set before you. Heal the sick in it and say to them, the kingdom of God has come near to you. But whenever you enter a town and they do not receive you, go into its streets and say, even the dust of your town that clings to your feet we wipe off against you. Nevertheless, know this, the kingdom of God has come near. I tell you, it will be more bearable on that day for Sodom than for that town. So Jesus, for or against hospitality? He says this is going to be the whole business of the enterprise. You guys, you 70, are just going to go out and teach, and you are going to depend on people receiving God's word with gladness, and the sign that they have received it gladly will be hospitality. When they set out a plate, you're at the right place, right? You don't need to go from house to house. If they set out food, you stay right there, and you teach as long as they'll have you. And in fact, in a condemnatory passage, he says, here's how you know they aren't God's people if they don't feed you. How bad is it if they don't feed you? Better for Sodom. If you're thinking of wicked places in the Bible, Sodom is going to top the list. Better to be Sodom than someone who's not hospitable to one of God's teachers. So if I'm a lawyer and I'm making the case for Martha, it's a pretty strong case. What she's done is definitely good. There's no question about it. If you're the attorney for Mary, what do you possibly have to stand on? If you're just looking at this scene the way we look at scenes all the time, one woman in the kitchen area with the servants busying herself, just running herself ragged, making sure everything's prepared, one woman sitting still, doing nothing. What is the case for Mary? What could possibly vindicate her? there's one and only one answer I can come up with, and it's the one Jesus gives, and it goes something like this: listening to Jesus is better. Well, that wasn't very well thought out. No, it's not. There's not a lot to it. There's not 100 verses to support it. There's not 100 stories to back it up. It's just a simple fact that Jesus is going to wake his entire judgment on. That's good, but there is something that's better. And on this occasion, it was more appropriate to listen than to be busy. Interesting, and I won't spend time here because it would take me far afield from my lesson, but if you go back and read that chapter, Genesis 18, where the beings appear and they eat and Sarah provides for them, the next scene, they say, when we come back, your wife will be with child. And Sarah laughs. She was hospitable, but she wasn't listening. They say, well, yeah, she was listening. She was eavesdropping through the tent. She heard it, and the angels even said, she laughed. And she said, I didn't laugh. But she laughed, right? She was listening, but she wasn't listening. She was being hospitable, but she didn't actually care what these beings had to say. She was going to do her duty. She was going to be responsible. She was going to provide. And then she was going to laugh off any silly suspicion they had that she would be with child. In fact, in one of the best jokes in the Old Testament, this turns out into the story of Isaac. Isaac, I've told this here before, but you know, Fozzie Bear always says, waka waka. Isaac is like the Hebrew sound for laughter. Yak yak, that's his name. And they name him Laughter because she laughed at the very thought. They essentially named him Waka Waka, which I think would have been great. But they named him Laughter, the sound of laughter, the closest name they could get to the sound of laughter. They invented a name that hadn't existed before this to describe the laughter, to describe the way she had responded to the message. She was hospitable. She wasn't listening. And that's the case we're going to see from Jesus. If you read then back in our text in Luke chapter 10, read with me verses 40 and following. But Martha was distracted with much serving. And she went up to him and said, Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to serve alone? Tell her then to help me. But the Lord answered her, Martha, Martha, you are anxious and troubled about many things. What's the crime that Martha commits? It's not a crime of doing anything bad, but she has overlooked something better. First of all, he describes her in the text in verse 40 as distracted with much serving. Busy is not better. If there is a lesson that our culture needs desperately, it would certainly be this one. When you work with young families especially, you say, how's it going? The universal answer from a young family is, oh, we're so busy. To the extent that you're ashamed to give any other answer. Think about that a minute. Why don't you say, we did nothing today, and it was great? Why don't we say that? Because it's kind of embarrassing. In our culture, it's just understood, you're supposed to be doing something all the time, always moving. You should be busy at your job. You should be busy in sports and games and extracurricular activities and involved in your kids' school. You should be at every meeting of every club you can attend. And when you've done all those things and a few more and are exhausted and have fallen down at the end of the day to start the next one tomorrow, that's when you have been a good person. You were busy. And that's how we describe ourselves. Oh, we're so busy. We're so busy. Busy isn't better. In this case, in fact, busy was distracting. This is a rare sentence because when you think about it, that last word, distracted with much serving, in the Bible, how often is the word service or serving a bad thing? Almost never. In fact, it's one of our motto words on the top of our bulletin, belong, learn, serve. It's the pinnacle of Christian maturity to become a servant of others. And yet Jesus said, you're using service as a tool of distraction. Because what do you do when you're busy? You don't have to think about other things. Right? I was thinking about some things yesterday I didn't want to have to think about. I was contemplating some discussions and some things going on in my family life and distant relative that's sick and so forth, and I decided I didn't want to think about it anymore. We painted a room, right? Because when you're doing this thing and you're sweating and you're tired, kind of hard to think about stuff. And I got to the end of the day, I hadn't thought about it all day. That works, right? Being busy, you don't have to think. You can distract yourself, and you did something good. Pat on the back, right? But Jesus says, you are using that as a tool for distraction. You are preventing yourself from growing by keeping yourself busy. In his own words, he says, you are anxious and troubled about many things. As humans, we tend to believe that we are the masters of the universe and that we can juggle all the balls and keep all the plates spinning at the same time. There is only one person who has that power, and it is not you. There is one person who in wisdom and almighty power sustains the universe by his sheer will. And that person is the Lord God Almighty, creator of the universe. It's not your job to keep all the balls in the air and all the plates spinning. It's not your job to be constantly harassed by your own determination to stay busy. It's not your job to be constantly worried about all the things you can't control anything anyway. Now, there's nothing you could do about it. But you think you're doing your moral responsibility by dwelling on it and thinking about it and wearing yourself out about it. Because if you were to pause and lay that down, you'd feel a little guilty. Jesus says, you are anxious and you are troubled about a whole lot of things. And that's not good. She looks responsible. She looks dutiful. In fact, she is distracted. Busy is not better. In the words of one of my favorite writers, busyness is an illness of spirit. It means there's something wrong with us. And we need to think seriously about how to live more as Jesus would tell us. Another thing we might observe is that better beats good every time. What she's doing is good. She's not doing anything evil. She didn't rob Jesus. She fed him. It was good. But there was something better. He says in that following passage, looking in verses 42, but one thing is necessary. Mary has chosen the good portion, which will not be taken away from her. One thing was better than all the good things. One thing was the best thing. One thing was superlative. One thing was above all. One thing was necessary. Do you understand? There are a lot of good deeds that you could do, but there are some best deeds that you must do. And it is a sickness, mostly an affliction of church-going people, that we can make ourselves distracted by doing good things as a tool to overlook best things. And folks, that is dangerous. I was lamenting with a friend of mine a little bit ago, a preacher friend, who were both preaching this passage this week. And we were talking about when preachers preach this passage, we always pick on women, right? Ladies, you're too busy, settle down. And probably, you know, there's something to that. The story is about Mary and Martha. But we were laughing because in our experience, you know who some of the greatest culprits of this are? It's men. Men who can get so wrapped up, for instance, in a career and think, well, I'm doing a good thing. I'm providing for my family. That's what I'm supposed to do. And use that as an excuse to overlook the best thing or the better thing. We do it in churches all the time. There are lots of tools and ways that you can serve, and all of them are good. There are some things that are better than others. I'm working from memory here, but there is an episode of Everybody Loves Raymond that I'm trying to remember. I should have looked it up, and then I could have given you verbatim the line. But it's a funny episode to me because they decide to go to church in this episode. The whole family goes to church. And Ray, like a lot of men, not crazy about going to church. This sounds boring. And sure enough, he gets there. I think they're Methodist. It's kind of a liturgical service, and he's just bored to tears. And he doesn't understand why his father-in-law, Frank, is so excited about going to church. And then he learns the secret. And this one is as close to stepping on toes as I'm going to get today. Please don't take this the wrong way. Ray gets invited to join the ushers. Okay? And at this church, there's like eight guys in the foyer. Okay? And the old men are all out there and they say, "This is why we love church. We don't actually go." I'm not saying that every usher that's ever lived is like that. Please, I love ushers. Don't get me wrong. That's not my point. I feel like there's rocks coming in my direction right now. But I remember the scene because father-in-law looks at Ray and says, "Don't ruin this for us." Right? That they had found a way to be busy. I mean, clearly they didn't need eight guys in the foyer, right? But they had found a way to be busy and not have to do something that was good for them. And it got their wives off their back. They went to church. They were important. They serve today. My point is simply this. There are lots of good things out there. There are also better things. And men are just as bad as women, maybe worse, at making a list of good things we can do because we want to be busy, we want to be active, we want to be fruitful, and the idea of sitting still and learning something terrifies us. It sounds dull. It sounds boring. I want to be active. I want to do something. But sometimes you got to hold still and listen. Sometimes that's the necessary thing. Sometimes that's the best thing. And no amount of good things make up for the best thing. You've got to spend some time in prayer. You can be the most fruitful and productive Christian you know in terms of good deeds. If you're not sitting quietly by your bedside in prayer, you're missing on one of the best things. It doesn't look like you're doing anything. I mean, you understand, if you shot a video of someone praying, it would look like the most unproductive time in that person's life. And yet that was necessary. If you took a video of everything Mary did this day, it would look like the most boring, unproductive time of her day. And Jesus says, this was the best thing she did. This is what you should have been doing. There are times when you got to hold still and pay attention to your God. And there's no shortcut to get around that. There are many good things. There is one best thing. What we learn from this story, I think, in three simple statements, is you can't listen to God, number one, if you're distracted. We are amusing ourselves to death in American culture. We have infinite numbers of distractions. There is always something else amusing to do besides looking deep within and looking deep in the Word and considering what God has to say. You can't listen to God if you're constantly distracted, which means you can't listen to God if you are constantly busy. It means you're going to have to say no to something that might even be good in and of itself, in order to make time for the thing that is best, to make time for quiet and prayer, for study, for meditation, for consideration, for worship. You've got to say that is best. And I'll make time for that. You can't listen to God if you're too busy for God. And third, don't let this one slip by either. You can't listen to God if you're too busy judging other people. Martha looked at this scene and said, "How dare she?" Interesting, isn't it? Martha had a lot of time to consider the morality of her sister. What does Jesus say? Maybe you should have looked in the mirror. There was someone whose behavior was lacking in this story, and it wasn't your sister. But you felt so bitter towards her, that's all you could see about what's happening. This happens in churches all the time. Where one person does something good, and they're the only one doing it, and they look at everybody else in the room, and they don't ask what they might be doing for God. They say, "Why aren't they doing my thing?" That's not the way Christians are going to be able to act. Ultimately, you have to find the best use of your time in service and in prayer and in worship and in contemplation. You're going to have to do all those things, and you're going to have to trust a little bit that other people are doing it too. You're going to have to encourage them. But if you spend all your time trying to see if other people measure up to what you think your great life is about, you're never going to hear what God has to say to you. Martha has to put down her plates just so Jesus can rebuke her. She never even would have heard this comment if she hadn't taken a moment to say something to Jesus. And ultimately, we have to recognize that this is a parable. It's a real story that happened, but it works like a parable works. It shows me something about myself. There's nothing deep in this story to be unraveled. Like, you need a commentary for it. But it shows you something about yourself that we need to take very seriously. We need to learn to listen, and we need to learn that that is the best thing. Listen to the Lord your God. Obey his voice and shape your life the way he would have it to be shaped. If you have not come to Christ in faith and obedience, listen to the voice of God and respond to him. As we stand and sing, you may come.